Hey everyone, Jerick Robbins here. I am coming to you not from our amazing home in Florida. I'm actually up in Michigan with my wife right now. We're getting ready to go see Flower Weekend here, which is something she's been telling me about for months, and she's very excited to show me. So I'm excited to see it. But while we're here, we have a special opportunity to jump on a Google Hangout with someone that I've been reading his book recently. His book is called The Way of the Seal. It is an incredible insight to some tools that I've heard about in my life. Or I might have heard from a seminar or two, but was presented in a way that's so practical and so useful and so insightful to just direct application to my life, the way I'm going about business, the way I believe a lot of you will be going about your business and your life, that I think is incredibly useful to use. So I'm incredibly privileged to have Mr. Mark Divine join us. So thank you, sir, so much for joining us on our podcast here.
My pleasure, Jerick. Really stoked to be here. So thanks very much for your time too.
Of course, it's a privilege to have you. And to get started, I would love if you wouldn't mind giving everyone listening a little brief intro on who you are, what brought you to this moment in this place in life. That way they get familiar in case they're not. Hopefully they are, but in case the ones that out there aren't, they'll get to know who you are and what brought you to here at this point in life.
Okay, I'll just assume that nobody is. So we'll start there. I am a former Navy SEAL, retired a commander. I retired in 2011. But the interesting part of that story, you know, a lot of people know about the SEAL, so you know, I don't need to dig into any extraordinary, you know, feats of courage or, you know, operational tactical things that I did. I wasn't on the Bin Laden mission. I mean, I did a lot of cool things, and it was an incredible time. But one of the things that really propelled me into the SEALs, when I was 25, which is a little later than most people, was my experience with a really extraordinary grandmaster martial artist who got me involved in Zen meditation and some other different types of trainings, which, you know, for a Western, young Western guy in the late 80s at this time, you know, was mind-blowing, right? It's just not something I had any experience with or even any contact with. And at the time, I was on Wall Street working as a CPA, getting my MBA at New York University. I was doing everything right? Six letters after my name, earning lots of money. My parents, you know, we have a long-standing family business that's over 100 years old. I was kind of being groomed to go back to run the family business. And while I was doing this training over 4 years, while I was getting my MBA, getting my CPA, working, you know, really hard, you know, I just started to experience these profound changes and inside of me, right? Insights were coming up and, you know, I was just shifting. And the work of whatever this grandmaster was doing, it was having a profound impact. And so much so that it literally cracked me wide open and led me to completely alter my life path and to join the SEALs, because I perceived that I wanted to be an elite warrior and to, you know, to lead people in those types of situations. So that led me into the SEALs. Now, because of the training and the way I learned how to use my mind through his, you know, in his initial kind of training and then a lot of experimentation, I was able to go through Navy SEAL training as honor man of my class. Now, we had 180 people start my training class in 1990, which is class 170, and we had 19 people graduate.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? And I was number one in my class.
Wow, so, those are insane numbers.
I know. And so the techniques that I talk about in the book, The Way of the Seal, is essentially a caveman version of an early version of those techniques, is what I used every day to get through SEAL training. And not only did it make it fun, but it made it a sure thing for me. Like, I literally knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, I didn't know that I was going to be number one, but I knew I was going to be wearing the Navy SEAL Trident. I mean, there was just absolutely nothing. I had such a sense of certainty about it because I had already won it in my mind and in my heart and in my kind of very being. Like, it was there. I had already accomplished the task, and I just needed to show up and put out every day. Super cool.
Wow.
And that's amazing. Got off. Isn't that cool? Yeah, and we can talk more about the techniques and what that stuff is. But anyways, later on in life, you know, now fast forward 20 years, I'm out of the SEALs and around 2007, I just had this real sense that kind of the next major unfolding of me was happening, and that I felt an urgent need to teach everything that I'd learned as a SEAL, as a martial artist, and also had gotten deeply involved in an authentic tradition of yoga, and everything, all those three traditions contextualized as warrior development started to line up, and they made sense to me. And I was like, holy shit, this is what I was doing that led me to be number one in my SEAL class, led me to be able to start, multiple businesses, and not all with huge success, but, kind of the skills to learn and to pick myself up, dust myself off, and to drive forward,
One thing you'll throw out there, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you said, many people know about the SEALs. For those of you who don't, this is kind of the elite of the elite group in the armed service of the Navy. And like you said, hundreds apply, 19 make it. And yeah, these aren't people who are giving it their best shot. These are people who are trained, who are the best at what they do. And this is the best of the best of the best of the best, all competing. And he said thousands of people actually apply, but hundreds even make it in, and then even 19 make it out. So this is like the most elite group out there if you aren't familiar with them. And the other thing you just said is you had some business success, and it wasn't that big or that huge. If I remember reading correctly in your book, that not big of a deal to you was in the range of like million plus in some of those ventures, if I read correctly. So for those looking in, as he said, wasn't that big of a deal. It wasn't that huge. He's talking about like $1 million plus businesses that he's creating and being a part of opening and founding and growing here. Right. He's a very humble man. Obviously, I'm learning quickly here. Just to give perspective, I don't want people to think, oh, he started up a sandwich shop on the corner. Like, he's doing $1 million type businesses. Yeah. And in his mind, the level he plays at, it's not that big of a deal. He's aiming for much more, obviously. But he's doing extraordinarily well as he was doing these things. But go on. I wanted to make sure the context was there for people listening.
I think it's interesting because I don't necessarily judge the success of the business by the financial metrics. My first business was a brewery, Coronado Brewing Company, down in San Diego. It's a $10 million business, hugely successful, profitable, and I'm super proud of it. But it was a freaking disaster when it came to my partnership with my two partners who were also my brothers-in-law, and it blew the family apart. My wife and her mom haven't spoken since then. I haven't seen or spoken to those guys, not because I don't want to, but because they're very limited and kind of small in their thinking, and they can't get beyond our disagreement, which was me trying to uphold the honor, my honor, and to do the right thing for the shareholders, And I talk a little bit about that in the book. So to me, that was a business failure that had the seed of incredible learning. And so it was a huge success. And the business is a huge success, but I made some big, big mistakes. And it would only be a true failure if I didn't learn from those mistakes, dust myself off, and move on, So that helped refine some of my thinking, because that was my first, so I went from being a Navy SEAL where my mission was clear. My teammates were even clearer, right? I knew I could trust with my life every single person that I worked with. We had a strong set of shared values, our vision for mission accomplishment and how hard we were going to work and the support that we were going to give each other was extraordinary. And suddenly, so I get off active duty and I go start a business in the quote unquote real world. And none of those factors suddenly were there for me. You know what I mean? And all of you guys who are in business and entrepreneurship, you deal with this every day. And so what I'm trying to do with the Way of the SEAL is to bring some structure and some clarity to thinking about how you can be like radically clear with your focus, and also with the team that you attract and recruit and then how you develop. So that you are with a team that is utterly trustworthy and competent, and that you're kicking ass and taking names together, and you're not in this murky ground of whether you can trust the person to your left or right, or whether you're going to get stabbed in the back, or getting pulled down to the lowest common denominator because someone, you have a real negative player on your team. And I experienced all that in the brewing company, and that's what forced me to say, okay, how do I apply these more tactical skills of being a SEAL to my business life? Because the first time around, even though the business is really successful structurally and financially, you know, I didn't have all those things that I had as a SEAL, you know. And so, but when you do apply those tactics, that takes it into the team and the organizational level, the way of the SEAL principles, you know. So we start, and I'll say this one thing, then I'll kind of shut my trap here. The principle is we start with self-mastery. We start with developing the character to be a great leader and a good person. And then that radiates out into the team level, the we space. So we start with I, then we move into we, and then we develop our team to be exceptional. And then we look at the organizational structures and systems, and we align those so the organization doesn't block our growth but can support it. And I tell you what, when those three can align, you know, the I, we, and the it, or the self, the team, and the organization, and support, you know, excellence, that's when you've got magic happening, right? And any entrepreneur who's got to build a business, they have to take care of those three realms. You know, you can't let yourself go to shit while you develop your business, and so many entrepreneurs do. Got to take care of yourself physically, mentally, emotionally, intuitionally, and spiritually, because that's, you know, the center post that's going to hold the team together, and then the team is going to be what, you know, the framework of the organization is going to hang on.
Absolutely. And I was just, I don't know if you're familiar with Eric Thomas or Dr. Eric Thomas now. He just got his PhD. No. He's a gentleman who grew up in Detroit, and he was homeless at one point, and it took him 12 years to get his degree. And then he just kept going until he got his PhD. Cool. And he's very inspirational. He speaks to a lot of sports teams. And I was just meeting with his team this morning, and we were talking about that as how do you create that structure? And it's something I saw in one of your videos online where and I'm curious to ask about this in that organization structure, when you're recruiting your team, when you're organizing your community, how do you go about attracting the type of people, and how do you go about communicating and creating an environment where even though there's a leader, the leader looks at his community as of service, and the community looks to the leader of service.
Right.
And it's something I saw where even in one of the trainings I saw you guys do physically, where the person standing behind someone, like a strap was loose or a belt was loose. And it wasn't that the person who had the strap loose or the belt loose was in trouble. It was their teammate. It's like, hey, why didn't you help them fix their belt? You saw it. Why didn't you do anything about it?
Right.
And it exists in so many teams and organizations and companies, right, where I might be worried about myself and I look over and I see the fact that you missed something, but hey, it's not my job. So why, right, should I care about it?
Right.
How do you start to train a mindset where people care about each other and their goals and their actions and results just as much as their own?
You know, it's easier to build it from the outset, you know, than it is to try to change a culture. That's for sure. In the SEAL teams, you know, this was just hammered into us. You know, the team trumped the individual, and then the mission trumped the team. So mission first, team second, individual third. And the way that played out in your scenario, like for instance, if someone's gear was all screwed up and it was going to compromise the mission, then it's my responsibility to make sure that that guy's gear is squared away, right? And I know that if I'm looking out for him, then someone's looking out for my gear, right? If you're done with a training evolution, you know, you take care of the team's gear first, then you look to take care of a teammate's gear, and then when you turn around to take care of your gear, you can be sure that if everyone's following this principle, it's already taken care of because someone has taken care of it for you. It's an extraordinary way to operate. Now, in an organization, this is completely foreign in the way that, you know, in the past structures, right? So, you know, one great model that we're toying with is called Holacracy, which is a, you know, it's creating a flat organization where you have, it's very much like a SEAL team organization where you have circles instead of hierarchical structure. And each circle comprises, you know, a real core function. And the team members then have total transparency and total accountability to get the job done that circle is responsible for. And so each individual has their primary role, which hopefully is aligned with their unique personality, unique gift. Like it's what they love to do. They're not doing predominantly what they don't like to do. They're doing predominantly what they absolutely are meant to do. But that doesn't mean they don't jump in and help out the other teammates when the task needs to get accomplished. And so just like in the SEAL teams, you know, if we had a mission and my job was to do this as a leader, it didn't mean I wasn't trying to do everything else. I did my job first. Some people supported me on that. But then when I had to go out and build, you know, we called a rubber duck, where we're going to throw a boat out of an airplane with a parachute on it, you know, that was an all hands evolution. And you can bet even though I wasn't required as a leader to go down and help out building that duck, that I had my hands on that and I was helping the guys out, right? And so the leadership then will get down in the weeds and get busy when they need to, and that shows that they're part of the team and they're there in a more of a coach mentor role. And then if the, you know, the team's working really well, they're solving their own problems. They don't need to surface every single thing that goes wrong up to the head shed. They really become a semi-autonomous self-managing unit. And only when there's a sticking point or if there's like a decision that they know truly is beyond their capacity because of the financial, you know, impact or something, you know, change of direction, only then do they go to the, you know, the next level up and say, hey, listen, we need a decision on this, right? It's an extraordinary process, and it's really, it kind of mimics what we did in the SEALs, and it's what we do here at SEALFIT headquarters. But ultimately, and I think really getting to the essence of what you're talking about, it comes down to the character of the leader to humble themselves to truly not have to have all the answers, right? In the SEAL teams, what the way that works for us is that I come in as a leader, and I might be, you know, the least experienced person on the team, yet I'm in charge. But if I go in there like a bull in a china shop telling people what to do, I immediately lose all respect, right? Yeah. I have to go in with kind of an open heart and say, okay, guys, you're the experts. And so in this situation, you're leading the charge. You know, I'll take the hit if we make the wrong decision. You know what I mean? And I reserve the right, you know, to make a call if I have information that's different than you. But usually, you know, they lead. They say, check, we got it, sir. You know, we got your back. Let's do this. And then together we just crush it, you know. So you really got to humble yourself to not have all the answers and to open up to, you know, maybe the decisions or the ideas will come from other folks.
One way I heard it said a while ago that was interesting is some people think of, if you look at old school, like kingdom, stuff like that, one person thinks, you know, as an unevolved leader, I'm the kingdom, so you're here to follow my instructions, do what I say or I'll kill you. The other, you know, an evolved king says, wow, I'm here, therefore I'm responsible for everyone here, so let me know how I can serve you best. And I think this falls under that evolution where it's the person who's the leader says, wow, I'm here to serve the team and the mission. What can I do to serve and how can I best organize this to make sure everyone served at the highest extent? And it's a really neat way of going about it. That's awesome. Reading through your book, there were lots of different techniques from box breathing to the having mental clarity and the mental gym what you create. I don't know which ones you like to share most often, but if there was one or two techniques that really stood out for you personally that helped you through some of the toughest times. And, you know, obviously when I read about SEAL training, there's some moments there, even the camp you guys produced, the Kokoro camp, I watched the video. It's like the first thing you do is a 45-minute plank. I was thinking, I remember yoga class, like a 3.5-minute plank. I think my arms are wobbling. My shoulder feels like it's going to blow off. I don't even know what's going on. So 45 minutes, and logically, I'm trying to wrap my head around it. I'm like, how do you make it through some of these things? It just seems insane physically. But I think as a business owner, I think as a mother or a father, there's going to be moments in life where it pretty much feels like you're going to pop. What are some techniques that can help people get through those moments? Some of your favorites.
Well, there's four that are ironclad, and I use these four in SEAL training. I use them pretty much everything, and I teach them right. I start teaching them right away. In fact, I've got an academy going on right now. I'm kind of watching them out in the grinder here, and we did a 20-minute plank. The very first thing they did, I mean, they showed up at 8:30, checked in at 9 o'clock, went in and said, I didn't even say hi. I asked one of them to give me a number between 1 and 30. He gave me 15. I said, okay, out in the grinder, lean and rest, which is a push-up position. And we stayed there for 20 minutes. I gave them a 5-minute bonus. And they all did it. And none of them had ever done anything more than a few minutes like you in a plank hold. And the way I got them through it, it was I coached them through in the process what I call these big four skills. The first one is breath control. So that's where box breathing comes in. Box breathing is a way to practice breath control. And so that is essentially really collapsing your focus to just the deep inhale through your nose and a deep, deep exhale. And this essentially triggers your parasympathetic nervous system, which is shutting off your fight or flight. And so it's calming you down. You know, most people get into those situations and they start breathing through their mouth and they're completely unaware and they're sapping their strength, right? And so breath breath is the first skill. Getting control of the breath, slowing it down, breathing through your nose, into your belly, and getting a full measure of fuel and whatnot. Now, the breath also provides a link to developing mental control. And it's, you know, I don't have time to go into all that, but that is the ability to concentrate deeply on the right thing at the right time and to focus on it with laser precision, and then to ensure that the content of your mind is the right content. And so it's not being interrupted with negativity or doubts or fears or anxiety, okay? And so you control your physiology with the breath, and then your breath then links into your mind, then we learn how to control our mind, and we tune it with positive cues, positive language, which is the second, you know, the second skill. I call it positivity. And, you know, the beginning of that is just changing the internal dialogue, and it's something your dad talks a lot about, changing, you know, both of these together could be the same as changing your state. You know, when I went to one of your dad's seminars, he was big on changing your state. Well, changing your state is changing your physiology and changing your mind, changing your thoughts. And you can do that with how you move and how you control your body, how you control your breathing, and then taking control of your thoughts. So for us, the skills are box breathing or breath control and positivity. Now, positivity has, you know, I could spend weeks talking and teaching that, but at its most basic level, I call it feeding the courage wolf, which means like using a keen awareness to always be paying attention to negative thoughts, negative energies, and always interdicting them and shifting them to positive to feed that courage wolf. The third skill is imagery. So if you're in the lean and rest and, you know, you're talking to yourself like, holy shit, I can't believe this. You know, how long have we been doing this? My arms are shaking. And you're going to have all this imagery that comes up that is going to be like a train wreck. You know, you're going to be feeling weak. You're going to be, you know, if you were to able to take a motion picture of what's going on in your mind, it's going to be disaster, right? Doom and gloom. You're going to be looking weak into yourself. And so when we shift that imagery and we deliberately replace it with like super powerful imagery, and the image that I had the guys use this morning was that they were a steel beam, right? So you're imagining yourself as a steel beam, you're breathing deeply, and now you're talking positively to yourself. And the words I used this morning, I mean, I had a few of them, but one of them was, easy day, we've got this, hoo-yah. Inhale, exhale, easy day, we've got this, hoo-yah, right? Inhale, exhale. And guess what? The fourth one is called micro goals. Well, having a goal, okay, 15 minutes, I got to make 15 minutes. That's your macro goal. Well, how are you going to make it to fit through 15 minutes in the lean and rest? 1 minute at a time. So instead of just doing 1 minute at a time, which I think would have really not been a great way to train, you know, this new group, I basically had them focus on something else for a period of time. For instance, I would have each go around the circle while in the lean and rest, have them tell me their why for being at the academy, have them tell me how they're going to change the world, you know, by aligning with their purpose and those things. And so what was happening is they're going around, everyone's listening to everyone else, and they're, while they're listening, they're thinking, how does that relate to me? Interesting. Wow, that's cool. Maybe I could use some of that. And so by the time they got to them, it's been 2 minutes, right? And we've gotten through another 2 minutes. Nice. So to summarize, those skills, which you'll recall every one of them from the book, breath control, positivity, visualization, and micro goals, they're what got me through SEAL training. And when I alluded to SEAL training being fun and, you know, just dominating it, those skills were why. I mean, there were some others, but those were the key. It's extraordinary what happens when you not – if you don't just think about these or read about them, but you practice them every day. In fact, Jarek, I would say that's probably the biggest thing or difference between what I do and everyone else does is that I'm not just trying to teach you some cool trick or some hack. Like, I'm telling you, this takes work. It takes discipline training every single day, just like the martial artist, you know, doesn't become a master just by, you know, thinking about it, right? Or yep, taking a one-weekend course. I mean, it's discipline work every day, but it doesn't have to be. You know, it's hard, but it can be really fun and really rewarding. You know, you get over the initial hump of the resistance, and then as you know, it starts to get really rewarding, really fun.
I think there's a curve that happens at some point where in the beginning, if you miss it a day or two, it's like, oh, I got to relax today. As you start going, you hit a curve where if you miss it in a day, something just feels off.
Absolutely.
It's like my head's clouded, my vision's weird. It's like something's wrong. What happened? It's like, oh, shoot, I didn't do my thing today. And all of a sudden you go through those four steps or you go through that routine and then it's like, whoa, the world's open again. I see life again. It's amazing.
Yeah. And the more you master it, the less time it really takes because you're able to anchor those states in and you're able to like, for me, 5 minutes of box breathing, you know, if I'm traveling, profound shift. Now I've got a whole process that I go through where I do breathing and then I'll do the positivity. Then I'll add my imagery and the imagery is all tied to my vision for myself and my business. And then I do some somatic movement, you know, usually what I call warrior yoga. And that's all I need to do. I can do it while I'm on a plane. I can do it while I'm driving, except for the movement part. I try to do it every morning when I call a morning ritual. And then I do an evening ritual. And then if I get an excellent workout in, which I try to also every day, then I've had a good day. You know what I mean? It's an incredible.
That's awesome. You mentioned something that I think is important, and I believe in it as well, especially since I'm recently married. I realized how much more important it is to have it right. A lot of people are starting to catch on to the morning ritual and having a morning routine. Why an evening routine?
Well, I look at it like bookmarks. You know, ultimately, what we're trying to do is develop the capacity to use our mind more effectively, right? I mean, yes, it's more than mind, but our mind is the executive agent. It's what's driving the show, right? It's not like our body just happens to show up at the gym. You know what I mean? Yep. And so ultimately, we're training our mind. Now, the morning ritual is about training your mind on how to use your mind in the future state. So morning ritual is about energetically preparing your body for the day. That's preparing for the future. Preparing to win in your mind by seeing yourself, visualizing yourself go through every major thing that you're going to do today, and also ensuring that those things on your task list, those meetings, those projects are in alignment with your purpose and are going to move the dial forward. So you're not wasting time. For instance, if somehow, you know, a round of golf showed up on my schedule and I have an important, you know, a few important projects to do, you know, I would literally say, okay, there's my chance to say, you know, send a text or an email or call and say, listen, I really just can't afford the time to go play this round of golf. I haven't played golf in 20 years because I can never justify the time. You know what I mean? It's just an enormous amount of time for me. So the morning ritual is about preparing to win in your mind for the day and to crush it, right? And using all those skills we've talked about. The evening ritual is about how to use your mind in a past state. So hang with me here. So in the evening ritual, we do some more breathing. This is more breathing to calm us down instead of charge us up for the day. So it's a little slightly different version. A little bit of pose work to kind of align our body, get the kinks out from the day. And then the visualization is what we call a recapitulation, which is a look back through the day. And we go back and we visualize everything that happened and we find the wins. We make sure we benchmark the wins in our mind or a journal. And we find the things we screwed up and we learn from them. We make sure that we don't drag those to bed like a kettlebell, you know, so that we have a negative programming or some subconscious thing to keep us awake. And we basically use every day to gain momentum in our learning and our growth. Now, what's cool about this is those two practices are deliberately training your mind, like I said, to use itself very effectively in a future state. So that when you execute during the day, you don't have to be in a future state. You don't have to be in this sense of, I wish I could, you know, I desire this. It's no, you're just working with laser-like focus on those things that are going to move the dial toward the vision that you had in your mind's eye. And then in the evening, you're training your mind to work in the past state in a productive manner so that you can kill what doesn't belong and choose what to bring forward in a positive form of a lesson learned and momentum, right? And so then you can also execute really well, more effectively in the present the next day because you're not having these regrets and this negative energy about what you screwed up the day before, right?
That's awesome. That's very awesome. I heard, I think it was Bob Proctor, one of these guys, they said something, the first thing you think about in the morning and the last thing you think about at night are the two most important things that cross your mind because whatever you think about last at night, you're going to sleep on and think about subconsciously all night long and then wake up with to start your day.
Absolutely.
And so this routine would make so much sense to say, right, hey, at some point you have to stop the input of information that life's pounding in your head.
Absolutely.
You shut off the world and be like, hey, I'm done. I'm going to go take time to clear my mind. You said having this routine that physically, mentally, and emotionally kind of re-centers you.
Right.
I like what you said about using what just happened in a really productive way. I forget the word you used. It started with an R, I think.
Recapitulation.
Recapitulation.
Most of my training comes from some warrior tradition. Obviously, elite Navy SEALs, yoga is a warrior tradition. Most people think yoga is, you know, spandex exercise. It's not. Traditional yoga is not. It is the science of the mind, and it was used for warriors to prepare themselves for, like, mastery, just like the martial artists use, you know, Zen and the martial arts to master themselves. And so I've trained for 25 years in various martial arts traditions, 18 years in yoga, and then I was a Navy SEAL for 20 years. And so a lot of my learning comes from those traditions, and I devour any book I can find, you know, around those subjects. And the ancient Toltecs had a tradition that a young man, like imagine us being 17 Toltec warriors, and we were really excited to join the warrior class because that's what we did. But before we could join the warriorhood, the warrior brothership, we had to do a recapitulation of our entire life.
Wow.
And what this meant was we went backwards in time visually, right? One day at a time, and we visualized every single thing that had happened to us in our life, and we made peace with it. We cleared the energy, made sure we understood the lesson, and, you know, we had you had a coach, or they had a guide who would, you know, work you through this almost like a therapist, and all the way back to birth. And it took about a year. Now, guess what they were doing during this process? Not only were they clearing all that energy, all that baggage, so they were completely clear of heart and mind when they went into battle, but they also were developing an enormous visualization capacity. And as you know, the ancient traditions all leveraged visualization for healing, you know, to understand their purpose and where they needed to go in life, and to, you know, to achieve the things they needed to achieve. I mean, that I look at visualization as kind of the next frontier for us all, because it is like another language. It's the language of our subconscious. It's the language of our heart. It's the language of intuition, and it's the language of our spirit. Now, sensations and feelings are also part of that language, but visual imagery is a big one, and we need to learn how to do it, because it's not, you know, just like you need to learn how to speak English or Japanese, you need to learn how to speak that language. And so that's where the mind gym comes in. You know, it's more effective to learn imagery and visualization if you create a mental structure, like a classroom. You know, you're going to be more effective to learn English if you have a teacher and either an online or a real classroom to go to. Well, same thing with visualization. So the mind gym is to create your mental training space. And every time you go there, it adds a little bit more of energy and structure to that, so that you can go there and do your work, and it holds your attention. So it's partly developing concentration, partly developing your imagery. And then when you go in there, in your mind, you actually do the work, whether it's healing or, you know, whether it's to visualize your future me state of who you want to be in your ideal state as a human.
That's awesome. That's amazing.
Cool.
One thing you said that was interesting is those young men going back and using those techniques. I think this is something that I don't know if you've ever thought of it this way, but I certainly related as a guy who's in my 30s, looking at life, certainly knowing my strengths and weaknesses and growing as a man. I relate to your material in an interesting way. When I read it, I remember my dad and I were in Africa, and we got a chance to go visit the Maasai warriors. And there's a unique ritual that happens where a boy becomes a man there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're missing one in the, you know, United States or Canada or Australia, some of these first world countries, we're missing these transition rituals,
right,
that just don't exist. And for some reason, when I saw your book and I started reading it and looking at your camp and different things you have available for people to go through, it almost came across to me, I'm like, wow, this is much more than just this.
Right.
But this would be a fantastic transition ritual for young people trying to find themselves. Because mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually, I mean, it prepares you for life in a way that really there's not a whole lot out there that does it in this specific way. And I remember, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but the ritual for the Maasai, just a 2-second summary, they literally have all the men dress up, paint their faces in warrior paints, and at 2:30 in the morning, they sneak into the hut of this young boy, who's like 13, 14 years old. They rip him out by the ankles. They throw a sack over his head, kidnap him. All the women cry like he's been stolen by warriors or someone. They drag him out to the middle of the forest. When he gets out there, they've dragged him, beat him up a little. They pull the sack off. He realizes it's his uncle, his cousin, his brother, his dad, yeah. All the guys. They have a little ceremony for him. And then they leave him out there in the wilderness for an entire year.
Yeah.
And the purpose of him being out there in the wilderness is to learn how to provide for himself, how to protect himself, and how to feed himself.
Right.
And the thought process is, if he can't do this for himself, he can't do it for the village. And if he can't do it for the village, he's not a productive member of the community. Therefore, right. He shouldn't be part of the community.
Right.
It's incredible. I was like, wow. I remember my dad elbowed me at that point. He's like, hey, there was a final test before dad elbowed me. The final test was you had to learn how to kill and bring home a lion by hand. So you're 15 years old and you got to drag home a dead lion by hand to show that you can protect the village, because it's a grazing village it has cows in the middle, then women and children in huts, and then a thicket fence, and the men sleep on the ground outside to protect the whole village against lions at night who are trying to get the cows. So wow. If you can't kill a lion by hand and you can't protect the village, you shouldn't be there. You're going to be a liability, not an asset. So I remember at that point, dad elbowed me. He's like, hey, want to learn how to become a man yet? I looked at him. I was like, you want to learn how to become a man? I'm going to leave you here. And we started laughing. But obviously, you're not training people how to kill lions by hands. But I looked at what you're doing, and I read your work, and I heard about the Kokoro camp and different right. levels, from mind training to the book level to all these different trainings you had. And it felt very close to home to me in that sense. Of this could be an incredible asset to use, even if you're already past the young man, you're 50 years old, but you never went through that ritual yourself, or you're 20 years old trying to find some way to graduate yourself and elevate who you are. I think what you offer would be a phenomenal resource for people like that.
Yeah, in fact, the only place that really happens, unless you are lucky enough to have an incredible father or mentor figure who takes you through their own little void of man crucible, which does happen, but it's kind of rare, is really the military, and in particular, like special ops. And so that when I started SEAL Fit, my original vision was to help young men become SEALs. And we have an extraordinary success rate. Like 90% of the guys who come train with me end up becoming SEALs. Wow. Contrast that with the stats for the average. Incredible, yeah, and so this stuff works. But you're absolutely right. I mean, so as my vision has unfolded, I realized that what we're doing with SEAL Fit, I got a lot of coaches now. We have a lot of energy around this, so it's gone way beyond me. Is a great model to bring into high schools, and so we're starting to take it into through the sports teams, and we do these 6-hour crucibles, which are like mini Kokoro camps. For the folks who are listening, Kokoro camp is our version of Hell Week. It's 50 hours of nonstop physical training, no sleep, rigorous, hardcore, cold, wet, tired, sleep deprived, nonstop training. And through that crucible experience, you realize, A, that you can't do it if you just rely on your physical, and B, that your mind gets fatigued and tired. So it's really not about the mental either, although that's critical. Ultimately, it becomes a spiritual quest, right? And then the second major insight is that you're capable of so much more than you think you are. We call that the 20X factor. Like you can do 50 hours. Everyone on this call can do Kokoro camp, but they got to train for it. And the third insight is you can't do it alone, right? You have to be willing to ask for help. And sometimes that's the most powerful insight, whether you're 50 or 15. We don't let 15-year-olds go through that program, but is that, not only do I not have to do this alone, I can't, period. And as an entrepreneur, a lot of times we go through this and we think, I'm a sole practitioner, not in the sense of, trying to start a sole practitioner business, but, like a leaders tend to put themselves on an island and they feel like they don't have any support. I did that for a little while in the beginning. And that's a big flaw, because ultimately we need the support of our team. We can't do it without them. And we need to get behind them or underneath them and push them forward and prop them up and, do all that stuff we talked about earlier. So that's what happens in Kokoro camp. It's pretty extraordinary. And as a kind of a streamlined version of that, we call the 20X program. That is where we're trying to work with the younger generation and to provide a no shit, kind of threshold event from, between boyhood and manhood. And there's a hunger for it. There's a hunger for it, I think, in our Western society, because it's there kind of is, gone away. You
know? Yeah, there's nothing really here for it. And I saw that just in my own experience with it. I was like, wow, this would be incredible to be in position for people looking for that kind of transitional ritual or that experience in life to evolve through and to have an experience with. It's incredible. I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today and obviously sharing so much and sharing those specific steps with people listening in. I'd love to ask two final questions. And one is just a personal thing I like asking people, which, I'll save that one for last. But before we ask that, I want to ask just on behalf of you for sharing so much, if people love what they hear and they heard stuff that stands out to them, they want to try one of these camps out, they want to learn more of how to get involved, they want to do the mental training or the book, or where do they go? Where can we find you online?
There's two properties I have that are, you know, probably the best place. And the main one is sealfit.com, SEALFIT, all one word, seal, like Navy SEAL, fit.com. No Navy, just SEALFIT. I hope I made that clear.
Yeah, sealfit.com.
Sealfit.com. A ton of really, really cool videos, a ton of content in my weekly blog. You know, it's just like reams and reams of really cool free content. Highly recommend, you know, everyone, you know, give us your email in the opt-in form, because then we also send out a lot more content and TV episodes every week. And it's super cool stuff. And it's all like really inspirational. And I teach all these principles through that. Now, people who want to go deeper, I encourage them to look into my Unbeatable Mind Academy, which is an online course. It's kind of like earning your black belt online. You know, the first session is 12 months long. Wow. And, you know, you literally train with me in this online course, and you have the option for a monthly call, a group coaching call with me, you know, that kind of stuff. And then you have a community of other people who are working on these principles. So everyone's practicing box breathing. Everyone's practicing working in the mind gym. Everyone's working on their positivity. Everyone's working on their goals and working on their ethos and their stand and working through all the different warrior disciplines that I offer. And it's super cool. And then if people want to get physical, that's where the SEALFIT Academy comes in. And so we have a 3-day academy. You can come live with us on site out here in California, train for 3 days. We have a 5-day. We have for special ops guys, we have a 21-day. And then we have the 20X programs around the country. So a lot going on there at sealfit.com. And unbeatablemind.com is the other one. And that has less information. It's more of a direct conduit into that course. And, of course, I've got 3 books. One was The Way of the Seal that you read. Another one called Unbeatable Mind. And then the third one is my physical training guide. It's called 8 Weeks to Seal Fit.
Very cool. Cool. So thank you. And if people are watching this, just to recap, there's 8 Weeks to Seal Fit, Unbeatable Mind, The Way of the Seal. Those available on the website, also I'm assuming Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all those stores. So go online, definitely buy those as an introduction. Definitely check out unbeatablemind.com. It sounds like a great program. I'm going to have to check it out myself. Also, the Seal Fit website is awesome. And I might be putting together a small group of people to come join you in that at some point in the near future.
Awesome.
You warned me, though, when we first talked. You said, hey, this isn't something you take lightly. People get their ass kicked right out of it all the time because they weren't really prepared. So if you're going to do it, take it seriously. Really put in the effort. Really do the training. Really make sure you're ready for it. And it's much more than just a physical experience, like you said. It's a mental, emotional, and eventual spiritual experience if you let yourself go there. Absolutely. That's remarkable. Cool. My very final question, and this doesn't have to be anything crazy or special, but I always like to ask people, what's the greatest lesson you've ever learned?
You know, how much time do we have? Just kidding.
And it's always the easiest question to wrap up with. So it's usually, it's this. No, this is usually a big question, but I save it for last because I think it's fun. Right. But whatever stands out to you, just something that's meant a lot to you, that's helped you in some way, or something that just moved you in a moment you needed it.
I learned from initially from the Grandmaster, Kaicho Nakamura was his name, that our potential as a human is radically accelerated or radically enhanced when we can merge our heart and our mind in our actions. And so, you know, this is the first person, you know, the first time for this, you know, my little pea brain as a Westerner 20-year-old kid, had anyone ever talked to me about heart, like heart-mind the power of the heart to help you make wise choices as opposed to just, you know, clever intellectual choices. And so then the question is, how do you do that? And that whole idea of merging your heart and mind is behind the word kokoro, or kokoro is how the Japanese pronounce it. That literally means warrior spirit, or to merge your heart and mind into your actions. And I believe that this is so necessary for our business leaders today, to be able to connect with their heart, and then when they're making decisions, not just think cleverly, not just, you know, use their brain, because the brain veers toward negativity, and the brain usually operates in first and second order dimensions, whereas the heart can feel its way toward third and fourth, you know, dimensionality. And you're going to make very different decisions when you can merge your heart and your mind and use them together for decision making. That's probably one of the most profound insights and lessons that I've had in my life, and one I practice. Wow. I work on every day, because it's, you know, it's a lifetime of practice.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. I love that lesson. And it's so, so important. So many of us people, I think it, with box breathing and some of the techniques you shared, if you ever get caught in a moment where you're struggling and you use the technique, you breathe, you drop, refocus, right, and you drop into your heart, all of a sudden that answer becomes so clear when before it was fuzzy and you couldn't figure it out. What an amazing lesson. I love that. Well, thank you for taking the time to join us and share such wisdom and insight with us. For everyone listening, please make sure to go to sealfit.com, go to unbeatablemind.com, pick up those books, join those programs, check them out online. And thank you so much for tuning in to another amazing episode of JRC TV. We look forward to seeing you all next week.